From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're taking a step back from international news this week. Instead, we have an installment in our periodic series of interviews with distinguished journalists and writers. Later in the program, we're going to hear from Mary Ann Golan, the director of photography at the Washington Post. But first, we're going to talk to Margaret, or Peggy, Engel. Now, Engel has had an incredibly diverse career. She's a former reporter for the Washington Post and the Des Moines Register, who is now the director of the Alicia Patterson Foundation. Now, Alicia Patterson was the founding editor and publisher of Newsday, and her organization gives grants to journalists working on long-term writing projects. Engel has also co-written books on topics as diverse as baseball parks and thrift store shopping. She's also a playwright who has written plays about the crusading Texas journalist Molly Ivins and the columnist Irma Bombeck. Her book, which she co-authored, Food Finds, about local foods, has been through multiple editions and has been spun off into a long-running series on the Food Network. Engel also helped create the $450 million Newsam in Washington, D.C., where she worked as managing editor. She's won a number of awards in her career, including most recently the 2017 Missouri Honor Medal. Margaret, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, talk to us, if you would, about the work that you're doing right now. You are the director of the Alicia Patterson Foundation, which is American journalism's oldest writing fellowship. It seems like it would be fun to give money away to people doing interesting projects. What are some of the things you look for when people come to you looking for a fellowship?
We look for urgency, because there are so many journalists out there who need help, and we're one little lifeboat in a big ocean of need. So we are looking for projects that are passion projects that simply have to be done now and that are very vital for our democracy to get written.
And what are one or two that you have funded in recent years?
Well, we have funded a project about the island of Tuvalu, which is probably going to be the island nation that is first taken over by floodwaters, by waters, by rising global warming. And there's no real plan for what to do with the 25,000 people who live there. Some of them are building boats now in the hopes that they'll make it to Australia, which is this huge distance of water that probably no one boat could ever make just on their own. So yes, that was something that was very urgent and needed to be done.
Well, as I mentioned, you have had a diverse career. One of the things you've done is you co-wrote this play with your twin sister, Allison, a one-woman play about Molly Ivins. She was, for those of us who don't know her, she's an incredibly colorful, outspoken liberal columnist from Texas. For most of her career, she famously nicknamed George W. Bush Shrub, or Dub Dub, I think. Tell us about her and how this project, the play was called Red Hot Patriot. How did that come about?
We had always been fans of Molly Ivins, read her column constantly, because not only was she funny, very, very humorous, but she attacked real news situations. She would do research till midnight on a Medicaid bill and then write about how it was affecting children in her state and others. So she had great substance, but wonderful wit. And I was going to be on a panel with her upcoming, and then we found in the paper that she had died, and I know that she had known that she was battling
breast
cancer.
She died in 2007.
She did. And so we decided, I called my sister that day, and I said, we have to write a play about her. And Allison said, of course. So we had never written a play, but this was an urgent reason to write one. And so we did a lot of research, and we had both been writers for a long time, and my twin has a degree in screenwriting and a master's degree. So this was not totally out of our wheelhouse, but we felt that people needed to hear her voice and needed to keep her alive. And we've been really so gratified. There have been about 30 productions of the play, and Kathleen Turner starred in it and has done it multiple times. And we're very thrilled that people still find a need to hear Molly Ivins' voice.
Well, writing plays about journalists is sort of your oeuvre, I guess, because you also wrote a play about Irma Bombeck, a humor columnist. I guess at one time was the largest syndicated columnist in the entire U.S. She wrote about everyday life for suburban women, for about raising children. Some of her books were titled If Life is a Bowl of Cherries, What Am I Doing in the Pits? The grass is always greener over the septic tank and A Marriage Made in Heaven or Too Tired for an Affair. Tell us about her and how you got interested in writing her life in the form of a play.
We also read Irma from the time we were probably middle schoolers, because we would see our mother just bowled over laughing, and we'd say, "What's so funny?" And she could barely get out the words Irma Bombeck. So Irma was an Ohioan who worked so hard at being a journalist, but then she knew that she had a wonderful facility for humor. And she took America behind the closed doors of what happens when, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, when all the men departed for work and the women had all the work from home and raising children. And it was an unknown world, and she just described it with such wonderful honesty and humor that we felt she was absolutely worthy of attention.
Well, as I mentioned, your career has been incredibly diverse. You worked as a newspaper reporter in the Midwest and then in Washington, D.C. One of the things you're best known for is your series of books or editions on regional foods called Food Finds that was spun off into a show on the Food Network. I believe it's in its 9th or 10th year.
Yes.
On the Food Network now. How did you get interested in doing this after having been a government reporter for newspapers?
Well, I really did this with my twin on the side to get some sanity, because journalism is a very emotional and tough and grueling profession, and you're faced with, you know, death, disaster all the time. And so we got very interested in regional American foods because my twin lived on a farm, and she saw that within a 25-mile radius of her were all these homestead cheesemakers and honey makers. And we realized that when people think that America is just filled with one Burger King after the other, that's actually not true. And Missouri is one of the places where its Department of Agriculture realized this early on and has just a wonderful listing of all the great small food manufacturers in Missouri. So what we did is just did that coast to coast.
Well, while we're talking about local foods, one of my favorite local regional foods is poutine, which is a French-Canadian dish. I think you find it mostly along the border with Quebec. It's like French fries with chicken gravy and cheese curds on it. It can be made Italian style with like spaghetti sauce on it too. But one regional food that I really don't like is St. Louis style pizza, which is sort of like a wafer thin cracker crust with tomato sauce and cheese on it. What about you? What's one local food that you love and one that you don't love?
Well, I like the Show Me barbecue sauce a lot. It's very good. And I loved Miss Hulling's gooey caramel cake, but I think Miss
Both of which are St. Louis specialties.
Then. Yes, yes. And toasted ravioli I love. But so many of the great local products that people knew have died out because they can't find someone from the next generation to take it over. And I really feel that there should be sort of a culinary endangered species, because we want to keep that diversity alive on our plates.
You also co-wrote the book Baseball Vacations with your husband, Bruce Adams. You traveled the country with your family visiting ballparks. How did that project come about, and what did you find? Are there some common characteristics to good baseball parks?
Yes, there are. My husband is a baseball maven, and I've loved it from a young age too. Cleveland Indians fan growing up. And so we found that every baseball park is different. They all have their own quirks. In fact, the one in Little Rock, Arkansas, sells disappearing ink and headache powder at its concession stand. You know, go figure.
Your most recent book that you co-wrote is called Thrift Style, about shopping successfully at thrift stores. Tell us about that. It does seem like you have a knack for turning sort of your personal interests or passions into professional projects.
That's true. I've always wondered when I would become either well off enough that you could buy things that you saw in magazines, where they usually say, you know, price available upon request. But I love the hunt of shopping, and thrift stores and consignment stores and vintage stores. And the reason that it's so important now is because of the whole issue of clothing waste and fabric waste. And so it's really good for your wallet and good for the environment.
Well, you graduated from journalism school in 1973. Talk to us just a bit about how things have and haven't changed for women in newsrooms over that time.
There have been some good changes. Back then, a lot of women weren't even assigned to the police beat because it was considered too dangerous or too raw. And I had to fight myself to get to cover Saturday Night Cops in my first newspaper in the Lorain Journal. That is gone. I also was paid $15 a week less than the guy who graduated from college the same day I did and started the same day. And when I found that out about a year and a half later, I got that corrected and they apologized. Most pay disparities, at least on the outset, are coming down. But I read applications every year from journalists, and they give their salaries. And I can tell you the situation is still not equitable. I'm appalled to see how much less women are paid still. And so there's a lot of...
And why do you think that is?
I think they don't go in and ask for raises, but I think that it's not really their fault to go in and ask for it, but I do think that the male employees go in and ask more often. But I also think that it's a systemic lack of pay equity and caring that everyone is paid the same. Really, you know, they figure if someone's happy and they're doing their job, they're not going to... take money out of their pockets by making sure that everyone's paid equitably. And also, so few newsrooms are represented by the Newspaper Guild, and that has an extra layer of eyes on the whole pay process.
You spent 8 years working at the Newsam, which is a beautiful structure in Washington, D.C., dedicated to the news. Tell us about your work there. What are one or two of the things that you're most proud of?
I'm thrilled that there exists a building that is devoted to the First Amendment, because so many people don't even know what the First Amendment covers, and it's vital today. But I loved getting a chance to collect artifacts from history, because what I learned is that so many of them are accidental finds. And one of them was the door from Watergate, the one that the actual burglars jimmied. And I was able to get it, and it was in a building engineer's basement. He had rescued it when the Watergate building was being renovated, and thank goodness that he did. It still has the seals on it from the FBI, and it's a real moment of history. We found footage of it being carried into the U.S. District Court where the Watergate trials were being held, so it was significant.
I understand you also got the Woolworth's lunch counter from Greensboro, North Carolina. There was a famous photo of a sit-in there in 1961, I believe.
That's right. It really set off the whole public accommodations fight in America, and this is a section of the Greensboro lunch counter. The Smithsonian has about 10 feet, and we got 8 feet. And I brought it up from Greensboro in my mom-mobile, worried the whole way that I would get rear-ended, but it's safe with two stools and the lunch counter. And it's very significant because these were college students who put everything on the line. The first four sit-in demonstrators were the first to go to college in their families. Two of them were in the military and ROTC. They really risked a lot. And then the women from Bennett College joined them. And then hundreds of thousands of Americans protested in lunch counters to get them open to all races.
Given your sort of background at the Newsam, I thought you might be particularly qualified to answer a question about sort of this moment in journalism. If you had to design an exhibit for the Newsam that covered sort of this period, 2016, 2017, 2018, what would you want to communicate to visitors about what's happened now?
I would like to do an analysis of fake news and how these rumors spread into and pollute the news feed that people are reading, and to show them why they shouldn't be so trusting or gullible.
So our era is like the era of fake news then.
It is. And I think that there's a good way to track it. And also as citizens, we've been a little lazy and we just accept at face value, knowing that things have been hacked and that bots are writing some of that news copy. And to show people really the care that true journalists take in assembling a story and how that is breaking down and how you can recognize the difference.
Margaret Engel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're taking a break from our regular coverage of international news to speak with some distinguished journalists about their careers and the future of journalism. I want to remind you that if you're interested in more Global Journalists, you can visit us online at globaljournalist.org. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter, or subscribe to the videocast of this program on YouTube. You can also get your podcast from iTunes or SoundCloud. Up next, we're going to talk with Mary Ann Golan. She was a longtime photo editor and director of photography at Time magazine. During her decades of work there, she led photo teams that covered numerous Olympics, the first Gulf War, the September 11 attacks, and Hurricane Katrina. Since 2012, Golan has been the director of photography at the Washington Post, where she's also an assistant managing editor. She's won numerous awards, including most recently a 2017 Missouri Honor Medal. Mary Ann Golan, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
Well, first, if you could explain to us in your own words exactly what it is that a photo editor does.
Well, it's a complicated thing. It's not just a person who's looking through the wires all day long looking for pictures. It's kind of a relationship building thing. I think it's often easier to talk about what a writer's relationship is to their editor when you think about a photographer's relationship to their editor. There's not a single writer in the world that wouldn't be happier to have an editor have eyeballs on their copy before they produce an article or a story. And I feel that many super successful photographers feel the same way, that you can be so close to the work and so close to the photographs that you've made that you can't see what the once removed person can see in the pictures and represent the reader in what they might see in the pictures. A photo editor assigns photographers to do different kinds of stories. A photo editor then edits through the photography with the photographer, then presents that work to a team, a visual team, whether you're at a small publication or a larger publication, but you're an advocate for that work to see that it's used in a successful way to bring across the ideas of the story you're trying to tell. So it's a multifaceted job. I think maybe 10% of it, maybe once you reach my level in the business, maybe 10 to 15% of it is actually looking at photography, and the rest of it is finding talent, promoting talent, finding stories, researching, putting things together, building coalitions with newsroom colleagues to make sure that you're producing the best kind of work for whatever your readership is.
Well, let's back up just a moment then and talk to us just a bit about how you got started in photography. How did you end up in this position?
It's a funny story. When I graduated from Brownies to Junior Girl Scouts, I got my sash and it was empty. And basically you have to earn badges. And I decided at age 9 that the first badge I wanted on my Junior Girl Scout sash was photography. My mother bought me my first camera and I was hooked. By the time I was 13, I converted a half bath into a dark room in the basement of my parents' house. And I knew that I wanted to spend my whole life making pictures or at least being near them.
Tell us, if you would, then, you were speaking earlier about exactly what it is that a photo editor does. Can you give us an example of how your audience, like the Washington Post readers, how would they be affected by good photo editing or bad photo editing?
Well, I think that you have to think about what you're trying to tell, what kind of story you're trying to tell. And I feel that visual journalism is exactly the same as written journalism in that you have to make sure that you're presenting something in a balanced way. I think that a really good photo editor will take two photographs and put them side by side for a photographer, for instance, and say, in this image, this person looks really angry. And in this image, this person looks a little more mild-mannered. What was your overall impression of this person when you were photographing them? Because if you chose the angry image and the bulk of the time that the photographer or reporter or people had been there, the person was not at all angry, then it could be an off moment that really doesn't represent reality in the kind of way you'd like to represent reality. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that does make sense. But maybe if you could just tell us just a bit about probably the biggest story you worked on. You oversaw visual coverage of the September 11 attacks for Time magazine. The issue Time put out on September 13th, 2001, won some really high-profile awards. Tell us, if you would, about that moment.
Oh, my gosh. Well, as you know, in American history, it was a pretty dramatic news event. I was the deputy to the director of photography at Time at that time, and she was on vacation. So I was running the shop on the day of September 11th. I had a really hard time getting into Midtown Manhattan because I lived in New Jersey. We ended up working straight through for about 36 to 48 hours to get that issue to bed and to press so that we could get it out to our readers as soon as possible. And we looked through thousands and thousands of images. We opened the doors of the Time and Life building to anyone who had photographed the events of that day and ran film from citizen journalists, professional journalists. We were supremely lucky because one of our most talented photojournalists, James Noctway, happened to be in New York at the time, and his coverage was amazing, to say the least. It was a dramatic and difficult couple of days there in pulling it all together, but I felt like the recognition that the issue got made us all on the team that worked on that issue so proud that we felt that we'd been able to hold our emotions and our energy and kept our energy up, but held our emotions in check, and were able to produce a piece of journalism that I think stands the test of time, that tells the story of a really tragic day in American history.
Well, as I mentioned, you did oversee Time's coverage of the first Gulf War. I understand you were posted in Saudi Arabia during that war, and you've dealt with a lot of war photography over the years. I understand there's been an ongoing debate within photojournalism, among photo editors, about the use of grisly images, images of people who are maimed, people who are dead, in showing disasters and in showing war. What's sort of your framework for making decisions about how and when you present those types of photos?
Well, I think that in the digital age, we're very, very lucky because we're able to put a screen in front of images like that that says warning. You know, graphic images will follow. Some people may be disturbed by this content. It's easier in the digital space to be very, very clear about what you're going to show a reader, but I think it's far more difficult in print. And I think that in the case of the Washington Post, my current employer in the print edition, that we still maintain with a pretty strong resolve that it has to pass the serial test, meaning that if the newspaper is placed on the kitchen table and the family sits down and there are children and adults and maybe even grandparents, if there are extended families present at the table, that they're not going to lose their breakfast looking at the graphic nature of the material that you're showing. I think that at a news publication like a news magazine like Time, where I spent a very large part of my career, that you have a little more wiggle room with that, because I think people understand that the news magazine model was there to give perspective to a story over a period of time. So I feel like particularly during the Gulf War, we ran quite a lot of disturbing images because we felt like people were more accustomed to seeing photography of war, and going all the way back to Vietnam, people had been looking at war images, and we thought it was very important for them to really understand what was going on.
But I understand during that war, one of the more iconic images was one of an Iraqi soldier in a Jeep. I think his arms had been burned off. And that was a photo that I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, ran in any major U.S. news outlets.
Did not. It was shot on assignment by Kenneth Jureski of Contact Press Images. And it was on the highway of death at the end of the first Gulf War, when a bunch of the Iraqis who had been occupying Kuwait were leaving, and the Allied forces bombed the motorcade, or actually convoy, of people that were trying to leave, and then a bunch of journalists went out there to photograph. So it was a dead Iraqi, very, very disturbing picture, who had literally burned to death. So the hands are there, but they're skeleton hands, and the face is a skeletal face. But if that picture doesn't show the horror of war, I don't know what does. It ended up only being published in the United States in a photography magazine, not in a news magazine, not in a newspaper. It ran an American photography magazine when it was still owned by Hachette.
Well, can you give us just an example of a time when you published a photograph where you were uncomfortable, or maybe even now regret doing so?
Well, I don't have any regrets for any picture that has ever been published. I have regrets that editors that I worked for saw fit to change photographs that I think, or to delete parts of photographs because they thought they wanted to run the photograph and not show the full content. That I regret. But the image from the first Iraq War that I think disturbed me a lot was a photo of a little boy who had lost both of his arms and he had been severely burned, and he was the only member of his family who had survived. There was an aunt, a distant aunt, touching his head. The little boy's name was Ali, and his family had lived in an area where Iraqi soldiers had put a missile launchers for shooting down planes, and so they were hiding artillery basically in a civilian community. So it wasn't surprising that there was going to be what they coldly call civilian deaths as a side effect of a military operation. But the little boy was in a cage, and they literally, like, so that nothing would touch his skin because he was so severely burned. And it was very disturbing because people felt like the image was an image that portrayed propaganda by the Iraqi government, because our photographers had been placed in a van and taken to this hospital to see what those allies had done to these children. I said, it doesn't matter. It's still a child who's been destroyed by whatever military action of putting the... Because we ended up having to report the whole thing to figure out where the house was, why did they bomb in that area, and we discovered there was a artillery group that had been in that area. Anyway, we fought and fought and fought in the newsroom at Time Magazine about whether or not to publish the picture. We decided ultimately to publish the picture because I said, how is it any different to be embedded with the U.S. military? Isn't that propaganda too, of them coming forward to fight the Iraqi soldiers? So we have propaganda on both sides. Aren't we balancing it by running both images? So we did. And the little boy actually got tremendous help as a result of that picture running, was actually rescued, taken out of Iraq, taken to London to have special burn treatment, got arms that are barely functional, but was able to get arms for him to use. So it was all very cool.
Well, our time does grow short, but I did want to ask just one last question. Because of social media and the advent of smartphones with really high quality cameras, it seems that people are just immersed in photographs all day long now. I mean, do you get the sense that this has changed how people receive your work and the work of your photographers?
I think that it's a matter of education, just like it has been with everything else. I think when we see, when we're living in an era when people talk a lot about fake news, that there can be fake photography as well. But I think that citizen journalism has an important place in news and news gathering, and feel like some of the most famous pictures that have won Pulitzer Prizes have been taken by amateur photographers. But I still think there's a very important place for professional photojournalism, because there's training and ethics and an understanding of the importance of trying to reflect truth. So I feel like we have to just keep educating about what the difference is between the picture in your iPhone and the picture in the professional journalist camera.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. Many thanks to Margaret Engel and Marianne Golan for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Astriga Gopian, Maria Caleon, Jamie Dunaway, and Denitsa Chikova, Shannon Sankey, Anne-Marie Welser, and Yanqi Zhu. Rachel Foster Gimble and Lauren Wortman are supervising producers, and Alyssa Blyle is our visual editor. Our director is Travis McMillan. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.